2012, February 7th. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 23, Terrestrial Worlds in Comparison. We're continuing our discussion of life in the solar system, and yesterday we saw just a general broad tour of what the denizens of the solar system look like. Today I want to concentrate on the terrestrial worlds, not the least of which is because the Earth is one of those worlds, hence the names of these planets, and look at some of the factors in their conditions and the evolution of their conditions that bears on this question of why or why not these surfaces may be habitable. So today what we want to do is we want to do a contrast and compare exercise. That's why I call it terrestrial worlds in comparison. We want to contrast both the properties and the evolution over time of the five main terrestrial bodies: Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. And since it happens to be there, the Moon is also a terrestrial body. As we're going to see, it actually bears some comparison to Mars and Mercury. So we'll throw it into the mix for five. What we're going to find is that the different bodies have different structures and different evolutions. So, for example, the small terrestrial planets are going to have very old, ancient surfaces, very thin atmospheres, and very cold interiors. The large terrestrial planets, meaning Venus and Earth, are going to have relatively young surfaces, geologically speaking, and very hot interiors. That's an important clue as to the kinds of factors that come into play for habitability. All of the terrestrial planets, we're going to see, and I'm going to leave Mars out of, the Moon out of this, so the main four terrestrial planets, all actually turns out probably started with very hot, heavy carbon dioxide atmospheres. But their subsequent atmospheric evolution was very different and leads to the planets that we see today. Finally, bring this point back about what causes, what drives atmosphere evolution, is it's not just one thing. It's a combination of factors we've already seen on the Earth, but now we're going to go back to that and see how that plays out on different planets. We're going to find that the atmosphere evolution is a combination of the greenhouse effect, the presence or absence of liquid water, and the gravity of the planet, the ability of the planet to hang on to its atmosphere, and also the ability of the planet to make its interior hot. These are going to be some themes we're going to pick up because it's going to tell us what we should be looking for when we're looking for possible abodes of life. And we're going to find an abode of life as a place with liquid water, as where we're kind of heading with this. So just a quick review here. These are the terrestrial planets, and I've tossed the Moon in at the bottom. They all very clearly divide themselves into the large terrestrial planets and the small terrestrial planets by size. The line here is pretty arbitrary, but basically the Earth and Venus are pretty close to being near twins of each other. They're nearly the same radius. Venus is a little bit lighter weight, at about 82% the mass of the Earth. Both Earth and Venus have substantial atmospheres. Earth has liquid water. Venus, as we'll see, does not. The small bodies are quite different. We're going to include in these Mars and Mercury, the two of the terrestrial planets. We're going to add to that mix the Moon. The reason for adding the Moon is it really isn't all that different in its properties from Mercury. It's a little bit smaller, a little bit less massive. It's only about 1.1% the mass of the Earth compared to Mercury's 5.5%. But we're going to see there's some similarities in terms of, if you will, their surface geology. Now, the difference, of course, is that Mars has an atmosphere, albeit a thin one, whereas Mercury and the Moon are essentially atmosphereless. They're free of air on them. They have a little tiny bit of atmosphere, but it's mostly just captured interplanetary gas, not a true atmosphere in that sense. So these are the divisions between the planets, and we're going to see that there's some differences in their evolution and structure. Well, the first piece we need to get at is to talk about what drives the evolution of a planetary surface. We've never really talked about this. There are going to be three factors that come into play as to what shapes the surface of a terrestrial planet, a planet with a solid surface. These are going to be impact cratering, volcanism, and tectonics. Impact cratering is where you basically hit it with a rock from the outside, you dig up a crater, you may, if you're big enough, punch through the crust. Volcanism is where you bring molten material from the interior of the planet and you flood it across the surface and, in effect, build new crust. And tectonism is a process by which the crust is broken up into plates and has further geological processing possible, depending upon the type of tectonism that occurs. We've only seen one kind of tectonism on the Earth. There are other kinds, as we're going to see here in just a minute. Now, impact cratering is very important for shaping planetary surfaces throughout the solar system, But it's only important during the first billion years of the solar system's history. During this period when there's a lot of debris still running around from the construction of the solar system, from all the material that the solar system was assembled from. But after a billion years, it's pretty well cleared out by the combination of the gravity of Jupiter and Neptune. Basically clears the solar system, and we see the solar system today as a fairly empty place. This isn't to say that impact cratering has gone to zero, as we saw last week. It's really hit a steady state about a billion in the last billion years or two. And we still do see new impact craters, but nowhere near the intensity we had originally. After you get past this initial forming, sort of plowing up of the surfaces with impact cratering, the next step is whether or not you're going to have some kind of active volcanism. Now, I'm going to define volcanism a bit more broadly than we do on the Earth. Volcanism means bringing material up from the interior and paving the surface with it. On a terrestrial body, that means bringing up molten rock and basically making big lava plains with new crust. We're going to see, though, when we talk about some of the icy moons of the outer solar system, there are forms of volcanism that are not bringing up rock, but bringing up liquid water and then having that water freeze on the surface. So you repave. There is actually a water or an ice volcanism we're going to see in the outer solar system. The other piece is tectonism, how the crust is broken up into one or perhaps many plates, and that then drives some of the geological processing that can occur on a surface. If a planetary surface, be it an icy moon or even a terrestrial planet, has no tectonism, you basically shut down geology. You don't have a way to recycle your crust. And this question of tectonism and volcanism really comes down to a question of what is the interior heat of the planet? Is the inside of the planet below the crust hot enough to actually melt rock? Because you need to have liquid rock to either have volcanoes or to have a liquid interior that the outer crust floats on top of for the tectonism. And of course, you can also turn that question into, if you're dealing with an icy moon, is the interior hot enough for liquid water in sufficient quantities, or icy slurries, same difference. So this is a theme we're going to return to a couple of different times. So, just to quickly recap, there's three forces that shape a planetary surface. Cratering, especially during the first billion years of the solar system's history, and then subsequently, if you have a hot interior, volcanism and tectonism. If you have a cold interior, things are going to be different. So with that in mind, let's now look at the individual terrestrial planets and see what it is that makes their surfaces. So let's start with the small bodies because they're actually relatively simple. Mars, Mercury, and the Moon have very simple surfaces that are shaped primarily by impacts and relatively early volcanism during the early phases of the planet's existence when it was still hot enough to have a molten interior. So what we see when we look at the surfaces of these worlds, there's Mercury on top, the Moon, and Mars, and I've just done a little computer trick to make them all the same size just for graphical purposes. What we see is we see very old, very heavily cratered surfaces. There's lots and lots of craters. In many cases, especially in the case of Mercury and the Moon, those craters are overlapping. So there's been repeated hits by impacts over time that have not been erased by either subsequent geologic activity or weathering. On Mars, that's not entirely true because Mars has had significant weather. There is weathering going on, but it's mostly wind weathering. Although we're going to talk about Mars towards the end of this week and beginning of next week, Mars kind of lies in between. It's a much more complicated place. When we talk about the Moon and Mercury, there's no weather. There's no atmosphere, at least certainly not in the present epoch. And so the surfaces we see are really ancient. In many cases, they're more than 3 billion years old. So when I say ancient, it means really, really old. The dates of those surfaces, they stopped changing geologically. The rock was last molten pretty much shortly after the end of the period of heavy bombardment, about 3.8 billion years ago. In terms of structure, what you see is that they pretty much have one single continuous crust. There is no division into tectonic plates like we see on the Earth. It's just one continuous piece, like an unbroken eggshell. And furthermore, when you do have some tectonism, what you get is a really what can be referred to as a vertical tectonism. You have motion of the crust, but it's mostly vertical motion, which takes a number of forms of what's called stationary upwelling. Material from below slowly working its way to the surface when the interior was still molten, pushing up on the surface and maybe coming through cracks and you maybe get a little bit of volcanism. Certainly on Mercury, we've actually seen some volcanism on that surface. So that's a form of tectonism. But that tectonism by the present day is all but shut down. So what are the forces of crustal shaping? How do we take this simple crust of silicate rocks floating on top of the interior and shape it, give it the terrain that we see? There's two ways. We refer to this as the primary crust and the secondary crust. The primary crust is shaped by those initial impacts. So you have the planet solidify, but for the first billion years of its life, it's just getting pummeled repeatedly by asteroids and comets, digging craters, sometimes hitting so hard it punches through the crust and you get this upwelling that goes out and floods the terrain. And it's an upwelling that floods the terrain and then paves over the original impact-shaped surface we refer to as the secondary crust. So the planet solidifies, you get primary shaping by impacts, primary crust, and then if you actually punch through the interior or you have some volcanic process that leads to this vertical tectonism, this upwelling that gives you a lava plain flooding out, that new material come up from the middle or the interior, comes out, floods out, paves over the old primary crust, and then when it solidifies, it forms a secondary crust. So, for example, on the moon, the dark maria are examples of secondary crust, whereas the lighter highlands, they're the oldest material, they're heavily cratered, is the primary crust of the moon. And to say primary crust is repaved doesn't mean it's free of craters, because there has been impact cratering since the last formation of the maria about 3 billion years ago. It was about the last major impact that produced a marial floodplain on the moon. Mercury also has vast volcanic floodplains. We've recently been able to map the surface of Mercury in great detail. The Messenger spacecraft is currently in orbit around Mercury and mapping it down to very high precision. And we can see that there are, in fact, lava floodplains. And a recent surprise has been the detection of volcanic vents. So if we look at the moon, the lava plains are pretty ancient. We don't see any particular venting. These are the leftovers of really massive impacts that blasted through the crust, got into the molten material in the formerly heat-hot interior and flooded out. But now the moon is entirely solid all the way down to the base. Maybe a little bit of liquefaction in the middle. That's still somewhat controversial, but for the most part, the moon is solidified in one big rock. Mercury is different. Mercury does still have something of a fluid interior, perhaps in the deep interior. Again, it's still being argued about, and Messenger is giving us some data on that. But we see lava plains, and we actually see volcanic vents. On Mars, we also have one continuous crustal plate. We see hotspot volcanoes, but the evidence is those volcanoes have been a very, very long time since they last erupted, hundreds of millions of years, maybe 600 million years, when the last major hotspot volcanoes erupted on the surface of Mars. So here's some pictures of past volcanism on Mercury and Mars. The moon, I should say, right now, there is no compelling evidence of large-scale volcanism on the moon having occurred, other than simply impact-driven volcanism. There are a few places where people see things like lava tubes, but it's really minor as far as shaping the crust. On Mercury, this is a beautiful picture from the Messenger spacecraft, shows this thing does not look like a crater. It's kind of oblong. It looks much more like a collapsed caldera. You can see there's relatively fresh material that's come up, although it was a very long time ago when this is active, because this area is now pretty heavily cratered. You also can see that this is in the middle of a fairly large lava floodplain. There are lots of blank spaces between these relatively large craters. Here's a couple of overlapping craters. You can tell old terrain versus new terrain by the cratering density. Right? Older terrain, it's going to have lots and lots of overlapping craters. It's one of the things we're going to use when we get further out in the solar system to get an idea of the age of a terrain, because we don't have any way to do radioactive dating because we haven't been down there to pick up samples. So we can use cratering as a proxy for the age of the surface. On Mars, there's an immense floodplain. You can see there's only a handful of craters around here, but there are these immense shield volcanoes. These are hotspot volcanoes, much in the same way that the island of Hawaii is a hotspot volcano. Well, it's on the middle of a single plate. The island of Hawaii is the hotspot in the middle of the Pacific plate. On Mars, the whole planet is basically one big tectonic plate. There's been a little bit of lateral sliding, perhaps at some point in the past, but there are this line of three very large volcanoes, and then this volcano Olympus Mons, the largest volcano in the solar system. It's the highest mountain on any planet, even in absolute terms, much less in relative terms. And to give you some idea of the size of Olympus Mons, the diameter of the base of the shield volcano is roughly the size of the state of Nebraska. So this is a huge, big volcano. And it's a basic, classic hotspot volcano. The structure of this volcano is really similar to what we see on, like, shield volcanoes like Mauna Kea on the Earth. But the difference is there's craters in the side of this. These were probably last active about 600 million years ago. So whatever geologic volcanic activity was going on Mars, it has ended a very, very long time ago. And the reason for that is these are small planets that cool off very quickly, as we'll see. We contrast that with the Earth and Venus. These are large planets with very hot interiors. They have active tertiary, third crusts on them. So the primary crust, remember, is impacts due to meteors shaping the original crust. Volcanoes come up and repave that, forming secondary crust. But then tectonism, active tectonism, will actually begin to continually reshape those crusts over time, adding on top of those secondary crusts. We can tell from the Earth's surface, from analysis, we've seen already the statement that the Earth's surface is around 100 million years on average. There's older spots, but for the most part, the average age, if you just plopped yourself down anywhere away from the continental shields, the average age of Earth rocks is about 100 million years. Based on cratering and other information, it's much more difficult because we haven't gotten our hands on any Venus rocks. The basic evidence is the Venus surface is about a half a billion years old on average around its surface. It doesn't, maybe has a little bit of volcanism today, but there's been no evidence of it yet. A few tantalizing clues, but no solid evidence. What's going on? Well, on the Earth, we've already seen what that process is by which the Earth is repaved. We know it as plate tectonics and what's referred to as lateral recycling. The plate is, the crust is broken up into a series of large and small tectonic plates. Some of these plates subduct underneath others and actually get pushed down into the subcrustal zone and remelted. But it's all due to this lateral, side-to-side motion, either collisions, spreading, or side-by-side motion in the transverse faults. So this lateral recycling is extremely important. We get the subduction zones, we get seafloor spreading, and we also get this upthrust continually going on, continually rebuilding the crust in various places, except in the very centers of the very largest continental plates, which are the thickest, heaviest material that so far has escaped recycling. That's where we find the oldest rocks on Earth. Venus, on the other hand, does not show any evidence of plate tectonics. It seems to be one big plate, but it also doesn't have any lateral recycling because there's no plates to bump into each other, but it shows tremendous amounts of evidence for vertical recycling, of the welling up of new material from the interior and spreading it out to repave the crust. We find an awful lot of volcanoes, certainly none of them active, or no, none of them obviously active today, but relatively recently active, due to mantle upwelling on the surface. And we also see some compression where the mantle is actually collapsing a bit, and you actually see terrain beginning to collapse. So you either lift up new material from the interior and spread it out, or remember, if you've got material lifting up, it's got to be pushing down somewhere else. That actually draws the crust down, and you get these collapsed basins. Here's some examples of this vertical recycling going on Venus. These are examples of, we can't look through the clouds of Venus, but we can peer through with radar mapping. And the Magellan radar mapper many years ago did a complete assay of the entire planet. There are two basic structures that we see. One of these are called pancake domes. They're given from their obvious shape. They kind of look like a stack of pancakes here. What you're seeing is vertical upwelling of magma, which pushes up the crust and kind of makes it bulge up and crack and craze a little bit. Kind of think about pushing up something from below. The other place are called coronae. Coronae is where you get downwelling, and the ground basically collapses. And you can see this sort of round fracturing pattern that's typical of solid crust being fractured circularly as the system depresses. These are actually seen to be high regions compared to the surrounding plains, and those are seen in the radar mapping as being depression compared to the surrounding plains. You also see a number of volcanoes, actual shield volcanoes with the classic cinder cone kind of arrangement on Venus. None of them have been seen to be active in the present day. There's a couple that look like they might have had some recent activity, but we currently don't have any radar mapping on the planet to monitor that long term. So people are thinking about how we might go back and do that. What drives this evolution of planetary interiors are two factors: the internal heat of the planet, and how fast that planet cools off. So remember, evolution is a change in property over time. All these planets started out hot, but they cool at different rates. And we have to ask a question, well, what is it that sets the cooling rate? Now, we can see this by the two stages of which a planetary evolution occurs. The first stage is the stage called differentiation. This is where the heat coming from the interior is primarily the heat of formation of all the rocks and stuff that was piled together to build the planet in the first place. That heat of formation pretty well melts the entire planet from core to surface. What we saw on the Earth was that the heavy stuff sinks to the bottom, the lighter stuff floats to the top, and you get this strong differentiation where you have metallic cores, primarily iron and nickel, floating on top of that, a crust and mantle made primarily of lighter weight silicates. And we see that in every single one of the terrestrial planets and the moon. All five of the terrestrial worlds are strongly differentiated bodies. They were completely molten through their interiors at the time of formation. The second stage is volcanism. The crust solidifies and you get this sort of shell on top of this molten mantle. And you begin to get the mantle is kept hot by pretty much by radioactive decay products. Thorium and uranium are the primary contributors, as well as potassium locked up inside the rock. Normally the stuff would cool off, but there's an additional source of heat that kind of helps keep it a little bit hotter than it would be otherwise. In net, over time, you tend to cool down. What this does is it slows down the rate at which you cool down. The other place in which you can get some heating is if you get a very, very large impact. That impact can lead to punching through the crust, and it dumps its energy into the mantle and can melt vast tracts of this. That's only going to be important very early in the history of the solar system when there are still 100, 200-kilometer-sized rocks that can do the impact and melt. After that, this radioactive decay takes over as the only source of heat available. And just over time, the planet cools off. If you have a molten interior underneath the crust, there are going to be cracks and thin spots. The magma is going to rise up. It's going to find those cracks, push their way through, and poof, you get a volcano. You bring molten material from the interior, and you use it to pave over and build that secondary crust. So the key to this is that all planets start pretty much the same way. They're hot and molten throughout. They differentiate. They go through a period of volcanism. So every one of these surfaces has a primary crust shaped by cratering and a secondary crust in which volcanism repaves that primary crust. But what they do after that step depends upon how big they are and how fast they cool off in the interior. Okay, dangerous curves coming up. Here comes some math. We go through this because it's actually pretty, it's relatively intuitive, but it's good to see what the numbers are. The cooling time, how long it takes a terrestrial planet to go from a molten interior to solid all the way through, is its cooling time. The cooling time scales like the size of the planet. Here's the proof. Okay? You have to start out with, what are you cooling from? That's a measurement of the total energy. Mathematically speaking, that's going to be a constant times the volume, which is going to go like the radius cubed, just like volume goes like size cubed. It's always going to go like the size cubed. Multiplied by the temperature. The temperature, remember, is a measurement of the internal energy of something. Temperature measures the amount of internal energy per unit volume. R cubed is how much volume you got. If your interior of your planet's, I'm going to make up a number, 3,000 degrees Kelvin. A planet that's much larger has a bigger volume at 3,000 degrees Kelvin than a smaller planet at that same temperature. So it's not just the temperature, it's how much material is at that temperature. And that's your total energy that you have to get rid of. How do you get rid of energy? Well, the only way you have to get rid of energy is to basically radiate energy from your surface. It's called radiative losses or radiative cooling. The energy loss rate is lost through the surface of the Earth or the surface of your terrestrial planet. That tells you right away that it's going to depend upon the surface area of the planet, which is 4 pi times its radius squared. That's just the surface area of a sphere of radius r. The amount of energy radiated per square area on the surface scales like a constant sigma times the temperature to the fourth power. This is what's called the Stefan-Boltzmann law. Any hot object will radiate from its surface like its internal temperature to the fourth power. Okay, so I got total energy scales like radius cubed times temperature, volume times temperature. The energy loss rate is the area times temperature to the fourth power. What is the cooling time? Well, I get a total energy divided by energy per time lost. So my cooling time is simply how much energy I've got divided by how fast I'm getting rid of it, how fast I'm cooling off, how fast I'm radiating. So I divide the total energy by the energy loss rate. Okay, put in the equations. Total energy is constant times radius cubed times temperature. Loss rate is area times temperature to the fourth power. And there's a bunch of constants that I don't care about for this problem. I do the algebra. A radius squared and a radius cubed leaves a radius there. Temperature and temperature to the fourth leaves a temperature cubed. So what I get is the cooling time is just a bunch of constants that make the units come out to something useful like seconds or years or something, multiplied by the radius of the planet divided by the internal temperature to the third power. What does this mean in words? What it means is hot bodies, things with a high temperature, are going to cool really fast compared to a cooler body because it goes like 1 over temperature cubed. I've got a large number in the denominator. My cooling time is going to be very small if T is really big. So you start out cooling really fast, and then it kind of tails off over time as you drop in temperature. The second piece is the size of the body. The bigger the object, larger the body, it's going to cool more slowly. The cooling time is going to be long. We all know this one, right? Walk around on the Oval today. It's kind of cold for a change. It's kind of back to normal winter. What do you see? Little skinny people have got to be bundled up looking like a downed grenade walking around the court trying to keep warm. But there are these really big guys who are wearing shorts. Babies have got to be basically surrounded by a sphere of down to keep from cooling off. Why? They're bigger. They have more internal. Right, we all have the same internal body temperature, you know, 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit or something like that. Baby's got a little tiny volume, only a little bit of energy, but they're going to radiate through the surface energy. The ratio of volume to area is their size. So they're going to have a small ratio of volume to area. If you've ever done time with a small child, they get cold really fast. Big person has a huge volume, but their area, their ratio of volume to area scales like R. So they have a very long cooling time. So they're like, what? Who needs a jacket? They're running around in shorts and a t-shirt. They can do that because they can better retain their internal heat because they have a little bit less surface area to run it out through compared to their volume. So the bottom line for a planet is a really big planet and a really small planet are going to cool at differential rates. Now you can see why we've divided the terrestrial planets into their smaller and bigger ones. They're not just different in terms of that size. That also has consequences for the rate at which they cool. And the rate at which you cool has consequences for your subsequent geological history because your geological activity is driven by internal heat. All right, let's get the math out of the way. If you look at the small terrestrial bodies, Mercury, the Moon, and Mars, these are small, they've cooled very rapidly, and they have mostly solidified. Not 100% of the way through, because there's still some things going on, but they're mostly solid at this point. They have big, deep mantles. So they have a solid mantle. Once the mantle solidifies, once the material underneath the crust is no longer molten, that's it. Tectonic activity simply shuts down. You end up with these very cool, very thick, very rigid crusts. So Mercury, as it turns out, for a different story for the Astro 161 class, has a huge iron core and a relatively thick mantle and crust. The Moon, we're still arguing over whether the Moon has a core or not. The latest data is starting to actually move in the direction that the Moon might still have a remnant core. But I'll put a question on that because people are still arguing about that. But it's solid all the way down. Mars has a very weak magnetic field, very weak, but still present. It's got a core, but it's got a fairly large mantle and a fairly thick crust. We see no signs of geological activity, of volcanism type of activity on the surface of Mars. And using the cratering rate as best we can, there's been no volcanism on Mars for 600 million years. There's apparently been no volcanism on Mercury or the Moon for more than almost 3 billion years. So these are very old objects. Mercury and the Moon have extremely ancient surfaces. They've only got a little tiny fraction of their surfaces are actually secondary crust. They're primarily mostly primary crust, paved and plowed up by meteor impacts, and a bit of volcanism filling in the cracks. Mars, on the other hand, has significant number of impact craters, but a lot more geology has gone on in its past, because the Martian interior has solidified, at least below the crust, perhaps even all the way down to at least the outer portions of the core. There's no more molten material that can make its way to the surface. Geology, active geology on Mars, as far as volcanism is concerned, shut down about 500-600 million years ago. And so we see pretty much a passive, dead surface, geologically speaking. There are still processes that can go on, but they're largely weathering and occasional impacts. So these are very different than what we see on the Earth and certainly on Venus. Which brings us to the large terrestrial bodies. These are the guys running around in shorts and a t-shirt on a day like this. Huge volumes, lots of internal heat, but the ratio of volume to surface area is such that they're still hot in the interior, and they have a lot of extra bulk, which means a lot of radioactive elements to help keep them hot. So it's a combination of things that work together. What we find is that they stay hot even 4.5 billion years to this day. They're still geologically active. We can see the convective motions in the core. We can see the presence of vertical upwelling and downwelling in the crust of Venus, although it's pushing up domes and collapsing down. There's evidence, but again, no hard evidence of perhaps even volcanism to the present day. So there is a molten interior just below Venus's crust. On the Earth, well, we've already seen this story. The Earth is extremely geologically active to this day. Volcanoes, plate tectonics, continual repaving of the crust. The average age of the Earth's crust is 100 million years. Venus, a little bit more settled down. The vertical upwelling is not as efficient a repaving mechanism, and you're more like 500 million years. But contrast that with Mars, whose surface is oldest, the youngest, is maybe 600 million years, and much older. Mars and Mercury, whose surfaces are billions of years old. So this idea of convective motion in the mantle, in the still liquid molten mantle, is driving the tectonism, is why they have these active tertiary crusts. They're geologically active places. This is important. Well, that's the planet's body. What about the atmospheres? We've already seen on the Earth that the Earth's atmosphere has evolved dramatically over the course of the Earth's history. It's changed its chemical composition as carbon dioxide has steadily rained out. There have been lots of changes in the Earth's atmosphere and its climate over time as a consequence of this. Now, the atmosphere of a terrestrial planet start out roughly the same, just like their interiors start out roughly the same. They have a similar starting point, similar composition, similar raw materials. The difference is simply the size. So during the formation period, when Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars were in the process of forming, the planets are molten. You're going to be too hot. You're not going to hang on to your atmosphere. You get very few volatiles because you're close to the sun. They basically don't freeze out. They stay in a gas form. And what happens is you basically can't hold on to the gases. The planets are too hot. The gases are too volatile. You just can't do it. But as the planets begin to cool down, you begin to eventually get the formation of a primordial atmosphere. As your crust solidifies, you get some outgassing from volcanoes, which begins to build up an atmosphere. The volatiles can't come from the outside, so they well up from the dissolved gases in the rock on the interior. Comet impacts coming in deliver frozen volatiles, which become gases, but now trapped on the surface of the planet. And the primary gases we begin with are carbon dioxide and water vapor with a little bit of nitrogen. So all the planets probably started out with heavy atmospheres of carbon dioxide, water vapor, and nitrogen at their beginning. Even Mercury. Even Mercury started out with a CO2, water vapor, and nitrogen atmosphere. And the question is, what happened? How is it they started out the same? Why are they so different? And the reason is because there are three effects that drive the subsequent evolution of a planetary atmosphere. We've seen these on the Earth, but we're going to add a new one, which is this planetary gravity piece. The first of these is the greenhouse effect. The sun heats the atmosphere, and atmospheric cooling goes into a balance. If a greenhouse effect starts up with having water vapor, carbon dioxide, methane, and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, it can make the surface warmer than the surface would be without an atmosphere. as we saw talking about the Earth. The Earth is 35 degrees Celsius warmer than it would be with no atmosphere. That's why water is liquid on our planet. So what this becomes important is it determines the overall global temperature, and the global temperature and the pressure determine whether water is going to be liquid, like it is on the Earth, ice, like it is on Mars, or vapor, like it would be on Venus if Venus had any water vapor on it. We'll see what that's about in a second. The second piece is, what is the gravity of the planet? Remember, a long time ago we talked about the retention of a planet's atmosphere. The gravity is how well the planet can hold on to the atmosphere it forms. If you make an atmosphere hot, those atoms are moving around really fast. If those atoms can move faster than the escape speed from the planet, those gases literally evaporate off the planet and you lose your atmosphere. If you're too small and too lightweight to hold on to a hot atmosphere, you lose your atmosphere. If you're cooler and you're bigger, you can better retain your atmosphere. Bigger you have more gravity, plus the cooler atmosphere, the atoms are moving more slowly. And it's that combination of gravity plus cool that helps you hang on to things. The final piece is something we've seen on the Earth, and that's the chemistry of carbon dioxide and water vapor, and water in various forms. If water, liquid water, exists on a planet, carbon dioxide is readily dissolved into it. It can then be transported from the atmosphere, dissolved into liquid water, into an ocean. And once it gets into the ocean, other chemistry takes over that precipitates that carbon dioxide out as carbon-bearing rock. We saw this on the Earth. It's what led to the Earth's carbon dioxide atmosphere getting slowly turned into a nitrogen atmosphere, because the carbon dioxide is getting steadily locked up, dissolved into ocean water, and locked into crustal carbonaceous rocks. So if we change the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, however, we feed into a greenhouse effect. So let's look at each of these pieces in turn. The greenhouse effect makes atmospheres warmer than they would be if there was no atmosphere. On the Earth, this is just a simple table, the Earth would have been 255 degrees Kelvin without an atmosphere. Water freezes at 273, but instead, because of the greenhouse effect, we're about 287, 290 degrees Kelvin on average. It's just one calculation. Under those conditions, water is liquid. On Venus, if Venus had no atmosphere, its temperature is closer to the sun, so it gets more sunlight, it gets more heating. Temperature would be 280 degrees Kelvin. Right about what you'd want for liquid water. But Venus, it turns out, has a hot, heavy carbon dioxide atmosphere. It has a runaway greenhouse effect. The surface temperature is 750 degrees Kelvin, hot enough to melt lead. So it has water, if it has water at all, in vapor phase. Mars is further from the sun. It's going to be colder, less sunlight. Temperature is like 214 degrees Kelvin, which is way below, about 60 degrees Kelvin in round numbers, below the freezing point of water. It's minus 60 C. The actual temperature is about 220 degrees Kelvin. So a very, very mild greenhouse effect. Mars has virtually has a very, very thin atmosphere. Not no atmosphere, but a thin carbon dioxide atmosphere. But it only gets a little bit of greenhouse effect from that. This makes it colder than liquid water, and so we expect that water on Mars should be primarily ice in the present day. But beware of these numbers. This is not a stable process. This, in fact, can be pushed into instabilities by changing any of the parameters. The amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which changes the intensity of the greenhouse effect, and it can work both ways. You take too much carbon dioxide out, the atmosphere can no longer warm itself, and it can get cold. Put too much carbon dioxide in, it can freeze. We saw Snowball Earth, for example, a few weeks ago. Or you change the amount of sunlight. Here's how it works. Here's how a runaway greenhouse effect works. Let's say we crank up the solar radiation, one of your homework problems. If I crank up the solar radiation, I make the sun brighter, I increase the surface temperature of the Earth. I'm just pushing more energy onto the Earth. If I increase the energy on the Earth, I get a high air temperature. A high air temperature increases evaporation. Warmer air holds more water. If I'm holding more water, I should lead to greater IR absorption due to water vapor, which gives me a stronger greenhouse effect. Stronger greenhouse effect leads to higher air temperatures. Higher air temperatures leads to increasing evaporation of water, liquid water, which leads to more water in the atmosphere, which leads to more heating, and you get a positive feedback loop. So I've had to really push the system hard, and I now make water the primary greenhouse gas, not carbon dioxide. what happens? As the oceans evaporate, they release their carbon dioxide. So now I've increased the carbon dioxide load on the atmosphere. The temperature goes up even more as the atmosphere gets hotter and heavier. Eventually, you get hot enough that you start breaking down carbonaceous rock. You can burn limestone and releases carbon dioxide. That releases even more carbon dioxide, which makes the atmosphere heavier, which makes it hotter, which releases more carbon dioxide, and the system runs away. And the Earth turns into Venus. And that's kind of what happened to Venus. Early in the history of the solar system, the sun was fainter. Venus probably had liquid water on its surface. It had a heavy carbon dioxide atmosphere. But it was so close to the sun that it was getting heated up to the point that water tended to want to be vapor in the atmosphere more than liquid on the surface. It shut down the carbon dioxide cycle that we saw on the Earth. You get a heavy atmosphere. Heavy atmosphere is like putting on a heavy blanket. As you get warmer, it's like adding an extra layer on the blanket because you can begin releasing the carbon dioxide and the system runs away. So Venus is an example of a runaway greenhouse effect. So that's one of the effects. The other effect is this idea of the planet's ability to retain atmospheric gases. Here again is a plot. We've seen this before, and we're going to see this a lot here in the next week or so. Temperature of the atmosphere compared to the escape speed for different elements. Hydrogen, molecular hydrogen, helium, methane, water vapor, nitrogen and carbon monoxide, and carbon dioxide. The Earth is warm enough and cool enough, that it's too warm to hold on to hydrogen and helium, but it can hold on to methane, water vapor, nitrogen, carbon dioxide. Sure enough, we have a mostly nitrogen atmosphere. There isn't much methane in our atmosphere because there wasn't much methane in our part of the solar system. Venus also has a hot, heavy carbon dioxide atmosphere. Basically, if these points are above the lines, it holds on to those gases. If they're below the lines, they lose those gases over time. Mars is further away and cooler, but it has a weaker gravity, so its escape speed is lower. So it actually follows the curve down. It could hold on to water, methane, nitrogen, and carbon dioxide. But it didn't, really. Something else went on here. What? Well, we're going to see that in a couple days, in a little bit today. Titan, really cold, is a giant moon of Saturn. It actually, even though its gravity is such that if it were at the position of Earth, it wouldn't be able to hold on to anything. But it's far. It's 10 astronomical units. It's got 1% the sunlight the Earth does, and it's cold. So cold that it can actually hold on to nitrogen and methane. And in fact, Titan is the only moon with a nitrogen-methane atmosphere. The Moon and Mercury are actually more massive than Titan, or actually the Moon, Mercury is more massive than Titan, but it's close to the Sun. It could just barely hold on to carbon dioxide, but just barely, and lose everything else. So the size of the planet and its surface temperature is what sets what kind of atmosphere you can hang on to. If you're a small object and you want to hold on to your atmosphere, you better be cold. If you're hot, you're going to lose your atmosphere. So what do we get? Well, Mercury is too hot for liquid water. It has a heavy carbon dioxide atmosphere. Its gravity is really weak. Double whammy. Basically, all the liquid water shuts down any carbon dioxide in water chemistry. You get a runaway greenhouse effect. The atmosphere becomes so hot, poof, it just simply evaporates in about a billion years. So Mercury started out with a hot, heavy atmosphere, but it simply couldn't hang on to it. It was too small and too hot, and the atmosphere was lost. And Mercury now looks like the moon. Venus, as we said before, in summary, was too hot for liquid water. You shut down the carbon dioxide and water vapor chemistry, and you begin to go into a runaway greenhouse effect. The water vapor actually makes its way to the upper atmosphere, is busted apart by ultraviolet radiation, and poof, goes off into space and is lost. So Venus basically completely dries out. And so we end up with a bone-dry, hot, heavy carbon dioxide atmosphere. The Earth, well, we've seen that story. Liquid water is abundant. Carbon dioxide cycle begins to set up. The carbon dioxide cycle steadily scrubs the carbon dioxide out of the Earth's atmosphere. The greenhouse effect is relaxed, and the temperature sets down into a nice, basic, warm, wet equilibrium. We get a very mild greenhouse effect, which keeps us warm, but not so warm we go crazy. And as a result, the Earth is a warm, moist, nitrogen and oxygen atmosphere. Oxygen due to life, nitrogen because it's all that's left after you take on, scrub all the carbon dioxide out, lock it up in the oceans and the crust. And then there's Mars. Mars probably had liquid water early on, but it was too weak to keep a hold of its atmosphere. Some of the carbon dioxide gets locked up into carbonaceous rock. There's evidence of past water, as we're going to see. But as Mars began to cool, the water froze. When water freezes, it can no longer take up carbon dioxide, and so the atmosphere basically begins to freeze out. The result is because of the weak magnetic field and the weak gravity, it's slowly lofted off its atmosphere. Mars has a really dry, cold, thin atmosphere. It's cold because it's cold. It's dry because the water is all frozen below the surface. It's no longer in the air, and it has a very thin carbon dioxide atmosphere. But, the big but, it may have been hospitable in the past. And so we have a very different starting point, very similar starting points, but a very different end point. The Earth is habitable, but Venus and Mars are not habitable today. Venus was probably never habitable. Mars, well, that's a different story that we're going to pick up later in the week.